could not be allowed to choose a side that might be against it. The alternatives were numerous and lethal. The Jack Ketch AI had earlier enumerated them for Cormac. Skellor smiled to himself as he pressed together the 17 fragments of the crystalline golem mind. Obviously the golem, Aidan and Cento, had torn the object from Crane's body and smashed it irreparably with a blast from a pulse gun. But what was irreparable to Polity technology was not necessarily beyond Skellor's ability. What most amused him was that the mind had broken along established virtual fractures, for Mr. Crane's mind had always been in 17 fragments. This was the nature of the golem's madness, and strangely, what had made sanity and autonomy a recoverable objective. His mentality, fragmented like this, Mr. Crane operated as the killing machine the separatists required, committing the most horrifying crimes and maintaining them in memory as disjointed, unrelated incidents. Meanwhile, always attempting to reconnect the 17 fragments and regain self. This he would, perhaps, have done sometime in the next 1,000 years. Thus it was that the golem had obeyed his separatist masters in that dangerous and erratic manner entirely his own. Roughly holding the fragments in the lozenge shape they had once formed, Skellor began to send Jane nanofilaments into it, clouding the crystal as they penetrated between the lattices. Concentrating on a single clean shear, he pulled the two faces together. Pecking along them on an atomic level, he cleared away oxygen atoms from the oxides formed on each surface, also organic dirt and minerals, anything that should not be there. Drawing this detritus away, he found all the major neural pathways, cooling nanotubes and ESCON power grid wires, and aligned them. There was some distortion caused by relieved stresses in the crystal, which he recreated. The two faces, drawn together by the van der Waals force of atomic attraction, snapped back together as if they had been held apart by elastic, and it was all he could do to pull the filaments out of the way to prevent them from being trapped and crushed. Two of the fragments had become one, and now he detected the nightmarish mutter from this piece of a mind. For a moment, Skellor refocused his awareness on his surroundings. Not having acquired the same resources he had possessed on the Occam razor, he was unable to split his awareness during such an operation, which was as intricate as anything he had done before. He briefly noted the man, Inther, lying naked on his side nearby, bleeding to death from where Skellor had torn his arm away. Marlin was motionless in his hole, though Skellor's control of him was not so strong as to prevent the man from showing by his expression the terror he felt. Mr. Crane's body stood perfectly poised, its balance system operating as if he was already alive. The human arm Skellor had grafted on to replace the missing ceremonial one only looked out of place at the raw shoulder joint with its swollen organo-optic interfaces. Inside that body, Skellor had built a device acting as a heart, lung, and nutrient supply, pumping round the arm an artificial blood supply. The human limb would last perhaps 6 months like this, but hopefully Skeller would not need it for so long. He returned his attention to Mr. Crane's mind. Interface after interface bonded, and the mutter of the golem's mind grew loud to Skellor's senses. Delving into this, he replayed scenes of murder and atrocity and perpetual imbalance. Quite often, Mr. Crane had been as much a danger to the people who tried to control him as he was to those he was sent out to kill. Skeller noted how Crane disobeyed some direct orders when the program, aimed at regaining the golem autonomy, interfered with the task at hand. Sometimes this program could briefly displace an order to do murder, so that, rather than kill, Crane found external iconic representations of each virtual fragment of his mind. Rather than kill a man, Crane had once stolen a pair of antique binoculars. Rather than kill, he had once taken a Tenkian dagger. Even with the separatist orders re-establishing, Crane would not carry out the kill order. For in the twisted logic of this insane golem, the theft became the killing. As the final physical fragments of the mind came together, Skellor decided that his own orders must not be disobeyed in any manner. So he proceeded to wipe the program intended to reassemble the virtual fragments of the golem's mind. But he couldn't. As soon as he attempted to wipe the program, the mind began to break in other places, in a way that would make it unusable. Annoyingly, what could make Crane whole and sane and autonomous was also preventing him from sliding into true oblivion. Remove it, and the mind would fall apart. Skellor realized he could erase everything and start again, but doing that would result in the loss of the Mr. Crane he wanted. This he found aesthetically displeasing. To possess godlike powers, Skellor felt, meant he should please the poetic as well as the pragmatic part of his soul. With the mind now cupped before him, like an offering to this brass god, Skellor stood and approached Crane's body. There was a Jane substructure inside the golem. It supplied the power lost by two broken micropiles and was mopping up spilt radioactives. It would also repair him, just as similar mycelia had repaired the Caloraptor creatures Skellor sent after Ian Cormack on Masada. Mr. Crane, dangerous though he used to be, would now be formidable. Skellor reached out and pressed the logend into its recess inside the golem. It snicked into place, light flickering around it as the structure inside him made optic connections. The Jane substructure, taking on a brassy hue from its surroundings, reached out like sharp fingers and drew closed the ceremonial torso as if it was made of rubber. The superconducting grid then rolled across and joined, then finally brass melted and flowed across the surface. After a moment, Mr. Crane, not Skellor, opened those black eyes. "Welcome back to your life," Skellor told the golem. Retroact 5. "Mr. Pendle," began Agent Bryonic, leaning back, his fingers interlaced beneath his chin. "Is this entirely necessary?" Pendle interrupted, waving a hand at their surroundings. Bryonic wondered what his problem was. This was genuinely in the style of a premillennial police interrogation cell, with a scarred and coffee-stained plastic table, magnetic tape recorders, strip lights. Pendle went on. "Do you know how many times I've sat in rooms like this?" "Enlighten me." "Precisely 723.
"There are worse alternatives."
"And do you know how many times that has been said to me?"
Bryonic grimaced, and through his gridlink accessed penal storage to change the VR format. He didn't like being predictable, so rather than go for the Caribbean island, bright shirts and drinks with umbrellas in them, he cobbled his own scenario. Now the two men stood in the uppermost viewing gallery of the Eiffel Tower. Pendle eyed the bank of screens to one side, showing a steel recrystallizing robot as it slowly traversed one of the ancient structural members.
"This is a new one," commented Pendle. "In my time, the damned thing had fallen down. When did they put it back up?"
"About 7 years after you died." Pendle's case had a certain historical significance, one of a defining variety of crimes committed around the same period. Prior to then, it would have been called, what, assault?
13 years ago, then.
Bryonic raised an eyebrow.
"You know I'm real-timed. Believe me, I've been counting the years in here."
"How long have you got?"
Pendle shrugged. "It varies. I'll never be loaded to a golem chassis while there's someone more deserving. And that's the way it always seems to be. I could be in here until the sun goes out."
"Is that so bad?"
"I can experience all the virtual worlds imaginable, but one thing I can never do is forget that none of it is real. It's a kind of hell."
"Will you tell me about your crime?" Bryonic asked.
"No,"
said Pendle, stepping to the window and gazing down.
"Why don't you tell me what you want with me? You're not a student. You're ECS down to the virtual chain glass shiv in your virtual boot."
"Again, it's probably somewhere you've been before. Your memplant was loaded to main storage before we discovered you had sabotaged 5 golem mines. Your history being non-technical and all your employment the same, it took a while to establish that you designed a program capable of all that it did. Luckily, we recovered the 5 before they killed anyone. The idea of 5 Golem 24 schizoid psychopaths wandering around the polity gets people in a cold sweat even now."
"Good enough summation, though I dispute psychopath. Sociopath is probably nearer the mark."
Agent Bryonic held out his hand, and an old memcrystal storage box appeared in it. "The deal brokered for you was that you told us everything. That's how you escaped direct, mind-to-mind AI interrogation."
Pendle grinned nastily. "Hit, how the AIs avoided it too. Knowing I'd designed that program, none of them really wanted to get inside my head. Might have been dangerous for them. Even now, I'm in isolated storage. At least other souls in waiting get a social life."
"You lied, Pendle." Bryonic opened the box to reveal the 8 empty compartments inside. Pendle eyed the box.
"I told you people back then. 3 crystals were destroyed in the process."
"The prototype Golem 25. You were at that launch for more than the free drinks and a chance of throwing elephant shit at corp execs. We know that now."
"I was nothing to do with the attack." Bryonic was sure he could see a touch of panic in Pendle's expression. Understandable. If Pendle was found to have been involved in that act of terror in which 18 people had died unrecoverably, no deal could prevent him from being utterly erased. The golem was seen on the out-polity planet Huma, the location, for the last 20 years, of a lot of illegal arms trading. Was the idea to break the golem for separatist reprogramming? This is something that has occurred since then. Bryonic could now see that Pendle really was scared. He might call his confinement in VR storage hell, but it seemed he preferred it to death. Luke, I wasn't connected to the separatist cause at all. As far as we could work out, you never had any training in designing sanity-smashing programs for AI. Okay, I admit it. I fucked up their prototype. But do you think, if I had anything to do with the separatists, I'd have been there to get nerve gassed too? Bryonic decided to let Pendle sweat a little more, even though the man possessed neither pores nor skin. Seems a good cover to me, and it's surprising that you were mem-planted. Not many there were. It was new technology then, and not wholly trusted. Bryonic shrugged. All you sacrificed was your body. Honestly, Agent, the program I loaded would not have broken the golem to a reprogramming level. It would have been schizoid, and maybe a touch sociopathic, and would have just become more difficult for them to handle. I never intended to make killers. You have to understand that innate golem intelligence would have prevented any golem, just for their self-preservation, from taking that path. Bryonic raised a hand. Okay, calm down. We know you weren't in with the Jovians. We just wanted you to admit you screwed with that particular golem. Good. Pendle nodded to himself. Good. You say it was on Huma? Yes. There, as far as we can gather, it received what is called by those in the know as an incline. A memcording of the killer, Serban Klein, is looped into a golem's mind until there's not a great deal left. Reprogrammed and remotely controlled, it makes a handy killing machine, though not a particularly efficient one. Mostly, captured golem are mind-cored, and the chassis used as a telefactor. Bryonic then noted Pendle's puzzled expression. What is it? He asked. It wouldn't. The golem.
Wouldn't what?
It would use my program, the schizophrenia. Multiple personalities locked into a hole.
Pendle looked thoughtful for a moment, then suddenly worried.
I can't be blamed for this.
For what? Bryonic asked dangerously.
For what it would have become.
Pendle? It was some time before Bryonic got Pendle to explain.
It could be all of them. Serban Klein, Polity Golem, Separatist Slave. It could be a most efficient and ruthless killer, immoral and amoral. And also utterly moral. I don't know if it could be controlled.
Dangerous, then? White-faced, Pendle laughed weakly.
Oh, yes, definitely that.
Retroact ends.
Thorn felt a fierce delight as he watched the shuttle descend, a feeling reflected in Gant's expression, even though his friend's features were artificial. Yes, Thorn had definitely been very much interested in Lelan, the rebel leader. She was some woman, and had pursued that interest to a conclusion he and she found agreeable. But as the months dragged on, his discontent grew. He had been Sparkind, one of the elite soldiers employed by Earth Central Security,
for most of his life and an ECS agent for the last few years, so was not the sort to sit on his hands at the bottom of a gravity well while things were happening out there. He wanted to be at the sharp end, no matter if it left him bloody. Drifting down on AG, correcting only occasionally with the fire blades of thruster motors, the Delta Wing shuttle settled on already crushed down flute grass at the edge of the Dracoman town. The air disturbance elicited odd whistlings from some still-standing grass that was beginning to lose its side shoots and thus take on the properties of the musical instrument after which the first Masardan colonists had named it. Dracomen of both sexes were now coming out of their dwellings to see what all the commotion was about. Mika, Thorn guessed, was probably still sound asleep after the hours of work she had put in on Apis, and Eldeen still remained at her lover's side.
"Well, let's go greet the boss," said Gant, heading towards the shuttle.
Following him, Thorn reached into his pocket and took out an item he had been saving for just this moment. He studied the circular wrist holster with its inset console, and was unsurprised to see that it indicated some activity from the contained micromind. But then, Shuriken, Cormac's lethal little weapon, did have some strange bond with its master. The airlock opened, and Cormac jumped out, a slight shimmer over his face, evidence that he was wearing polity breather gear. As the agent came over, Thorn noticed other ships descending.
"I'm not being told much," said Gant, also looking skyward.
"Well," said Cormac, "ECS will be establishing a facility down here, but we won't be here to see it."
"What fish are we frying, then?" asked Thorn.
Curious expression, but perhaps apposite. Cormac told them who the fish was.
"He survived it, that bastard," said Thorn.
Cormac nodded. "We go after him. I want you two with me. I also want Mika for her expertise. You're prepared to come?"
"Damned right I am," said Thorn.
Cormac nodded. "The alternative is that you stay here under observation to make sure that mycelium inside you doesn't pose a danger."
"A danger has already been revealed," Gant said, "though not one to others."
But Cormac wasn't paying attention. Thorn was holding out the shuriken holster.
Cormac took it and in one swift movement strapped it on his wrist. He grinned, then abruptly turned to Gant.
"What danger?" Gant showed him.
A low, muttering vibration transmitted up through the soles of his boots, and Anderson wondered just how safe this place was ever since the quakes began. No doubt many would be glad to see it fall, as many blamed the quakes on the increased mining engendered by Metalier expansion. Looking round, Anderson also wondered if people lived like this on old Earth, or out there amid the stars. He took in the crowds, the tall metal pillars supporting oblate houses of anodized metal and glass, the numerous walkways and floors all supported by webworks of steel trusses. He guessed not, for the purpose of suspending dwellings like this was to keep out some of the less welcome sand-crawling denizens of Kull, and by night these people would be safely sealed up in their homes.
"And what did this Lafrostan see?"
Turgal asked him from the other side of the cafe table. Still studying his surroundings, noting dust being shaken down from high surfaces, Anderson continued his tale.
"Lafrostan saw a moon descend upon the plain. But when he journeyed there, he found no sign of it. Wounded by Sleer, then deserted by the gully traders he had promised a fortune, for he was sure that rare metal ores would be found at the point of impact, he struggled on foot across the plains. In the wilderness, the dragon came out of the ground and spoke to him. It said, "Come no further. This is now my realm. No man may walk here." Lafroston returned to the city of the Metaliers, but none here believed his story. He told it then in all the towns from Provence to the mountains of Rondur, where as a boy I heard it. When the time of my trial as a knight of Rondur came, I chose to retrace his journey and slay the dragon.
Anderson turned to observe a long vehicle, segmented like a louse, laboring up the street, its vibration adding to that of the quake. Mostly the vehicles here were personal transports, like the one in which LaForge had brought them here, and he wondered at the purpose of this one. He then transferred his gaze further down the street and up to where, through the industrial fog and dust, the Overcity rested on the sand towers like some fairy castle, but with tangles of suspended roads leading to it. How big a quake would it take to bring that down? Turgle regarded Anderson over the rim of his glass of lichen beer.
"Why do you want to kill a dragon?"
Anderson returned his attention to the boy, then glanced aside at the boxes containing his own recent purchases.
"Call it the impetuousness of youth."
Anderson rubbed at the scars either side of his top lip, where his lip tendrils had been removed. He grimaced, remembering the pain of the manhood ceremony and the joyful arrogance that came after.
"In many of the ancient stories, that's what you do to dragons, slay them, though in many others they are companions and friends of man. It was the course I chose, and having chosen it, must pursue it, as that is the nature of the trial. 20 years of traveling have changed my attitude somewhat."
"It doesn't take 20 years by Sandhawk to get from Rondur to here," Turgle observed.
"No, let's say my journey has been rather convoluted and interesting. And I've learned a lot."
"But you still intend to slay the dragon?"
Anderson grimaced in irritation.
"I'm too close now to turn aside. I'll provide myself with the means of dragon slaying, and I will find the dragon. I rather suspect that what happens then depends on what the dragon itself does. Again, it is the nature of the trial, the journey being more important than arrival. But tell me, Turgle, what about your journey?"
Turgle sipped his beer, then gestured airily towards the window.
"I'm a gully trader by birth. We don't need any trial to set us traveling."
"Yes, but normally in caravans, not alone. Anyway, you said your stepfather was a mineralier," Anderson observed.
"My birth father was sucked down into a sand maelstrom, and my mother then hooked herself to a man I had no liking for. I took Stone, my sandhog, and left to go take a look at the world. My journey has been aimless, but I wonder how much more so than yours."
Anderson nodded, then picked up a roasted rock louse, broke it open, pulled out the thumb of flesh it contained, ate it. He eyed the ripples in his shot glass of quavit before picking it up and taking a sip.
"True, this has been a journey I've not wanted to end, but I don't consider the acquisition of knowledge to be aimless."
Just then something crashed down amid the buildings on the other side of the street. Anderson noted that many citizens were now picking up their pace and looking about themselves nervously. But it seemed the quake had reached its peak, for it now began to tail off.
"So why are you going to end your journey?" Turgle asked,
pretending negligent unconcern about the vibrating ground, Anderson thought.
"I don't think I will, really. I'll travel through the sand towers up onto the plains and find my dragon. Then I'll probably just carry on. I guess the reason I'm going is that I've seen all I feel inclined to see, this side of the towers."
"What about money?" Turgle asked. Anderson did not feel inclined to answer that. Being kind, he could suppose the boy was discomforted by the fact that Anderson had paid for their room, for the hog corral, and now for this food and drink. But, being himself, he also felt sure the boy was in the process of deciding whether or not Anderson was worth the risk of robbing. He'd made no move so far. Anderson had been watching. But then, perhaps he was a meticulous and careful thief.
"I suspect I won't be requiring much money until I reach the other side of the plains. There's not many people live between here and there," the knight replied.
"But you'll be needing supplies."
"Yes."
"Then so will I."
Anderson watched as the boy picked up the small rucksack he had brought along in LaForge's small diesel car and opened it on the table to reveal some fine lumps of yellow jade. He felt a sudden tiredness of this intimation of Turgle's past, combined with a hope for the boy's future, that he intended to use his ill-gotten gains to obtain supplies, perhaps meant he did not intend to rob Anderson, at least yet.
"You think I'll find a buyer for this here?" Turgle asked.
"I should think so. You intend to accompany me, then?"
Turgle replied, "I've seen a maelstrom and a singing tornado, and I once saw the inconstant sea fleeing between dunes, but I have never seen a dragon."
Was that it? Was the boy now attracted to a different and less criminal adventure? Anderson hoped so, but knowing human nature so well, he did not have much faith in redemption. As Turgle stood, Anderson returned his attention to his surroundings, and then, as the boy moved away, turned his mind to other thoughts. The quake had ceased, and, as always, Anderson wondered what was causing them. He had read about earthquakes in the library of Rondure, just as he had read about so many other things that for many years had no bearing on the people of Kull. Here, on this old world, the radioactives cycled up from the planet's core were all but spent, and as the magma cooled, the crust just grew steadily thicker. Plate tectonics were non-existent. The crust was one big plate. There should be no earthquakes. There was little sign of the drastic procedure Gant had described. But then, as Cormac knew from personal experience, it was possible to cell-weld the most severe injuries so that no visible sign remained. Apis lay flat on the surgical table with thin optic wires leading to probes in his body, and the various tubes connecting him to the area of the autodock Cormac recognized as containing its filtration equipment. Eldine glanced up from the chair she had sprawled in beside the supine outlinker before returning her attention to her lover. She looked tired, worn out by worry.
"So you're back," was all she said.
"What is Mika's prognosis for him?" Cormac asked. At her puzzled expression, he added, "Does she say he'll recover?"
"She doesn't know. She said broken and dying filaments inside him will perpetually poison him, while others still alive may start to grow out of control, Eldin replied, then looked past him as the door behind opened. Cormac looked round and studied Mika as she entered the room. Tired, obviously, and perhaps a little guilty. She gazed at Apis, then turned her attention to Cormac. "The quarantine is over?" she suggested.
"Not entirely. First of all, the Jane technology here must be secured and made safe."
"All Jane technology," Mika stated, again trying not to make it a question.
Cormac nodded towards Apis and Eldin. "These two will have to stay under observation here in Apolity Base. You and Thorn will also remain under observation while you accompany me."
Eldin abruptly stood up. "Apis cannot be moved."
"He won't be moved, not until it is safe to do so," Cormac replied.
Eldin looked at Mika, seeking some kind of support, some reassurance from her.
Mika said, "There will be doctors and surgeons coming here with abilities equal to, if not in excess, of my own, and with more polity technology to employ. I am primarily a research scientist. He will do better with them."
This seemed to satisfy Eldin, and she just as abruptly sat down again. Cormac again studied Mika's expression. "What went wrong?" Mika rubbed at her face. "In the days when we couldn't correct them, faults in DNA led to cancers. The chemical machinery of the mycelia I made is not DNA, but is just as complex."
"Faults?" Cormac raised an eyebrow.
"There's something you must see," said Mika, gesturing for Cormac to follow her. When Gant and Thorn also moved to follow, she held up her hand. "This is for the agent only."
The two seemed set to object, but with a look, Cormac stilled any protest. He then leavened this by leaning in close to them and whispering, "Get your stuff ready. We ship out as soon as possible."
Mika led him out of the surgical facility and into a room kitted out much like a research laboratory aboard a spaceship. Once Cormac closed the door, she indicated a cylindrical chain glass tank standing on one of the counters. "That's what I took out of him," she said. Cormac studied the tank's contents. The mycelium was moving slowly, and in some places had etched marks into the tough chain glass. He noted the woody, fibrous structure of the thing and the nodal growths within it.
"Interesting. But what is it you want to tell me?"
"It is difficult to admit to error sometimes."
Cormac instantly understood why she had not wanted the others present, and he waited for her confession.
She continued, "The mycelia I made, or rather transcribed, must have been faulty, though I've yet to discover what that fault is. Certainly it is some kind of copying error in its contained blueprint, its DNA, if you like."
She gestured at the writhing mycelium.
"These are becoming cancerous. I can only surmise that the nodes you see there are tumours."
"You said the mycelia you made."
She nodded. "Probably this is not the case in the original, and the four I made are all exactly the same."
"So what happened to Apis will happen to Eldin, Thorn, and yourself?"
"Yes, it's happening now."
Cormac considered her guilt. "Apis would have been dead by now without it, as would you, after being shot by that theocracy soldier."
"But Thorn and Eldin..."
Cormac grimaced. "You made a mistake, Mika."
He thought about Elysium, and the deaths he himself had indirectly caused there. But in your time, you have saved more lives than you have taken. That's the best any of us can hope for. But I still made a mistake, Mika said woodenly. Chapter 5 Artifacts, Part 16 The three ancient races, the Athata, Jain, and the Xorians, are named after, respectively, a kind of ceramic blade, the daughter of Alexion Smith. She was the first to discover a Jain artifact, and an archaeologist, sneezing as he named his new discovery, though that's probably apocryphal. The Jain breathed their last over 5 million years ago, supposing they breathed at all. For the Xorians, it was maybe a million, and the jury is still out on the Athata, as some artifacts apparently attributable to them have been dated at both 3 million years and half a million years. Huge efforts are being made to find anything left by these races. There are whole industries involved in the search. Rumour abounds, some of it quite ridiculous. Is it true that a fossilised Xorian has been found? That a Jain was found in stasis, floating in space, revived and then killed? What about this evidence that they actually altered the shape of star systems? Is it true that ancient and lethal technologies have been tested on condemned prisoners on deserted worlds? The subject of these three, in massive virtualities, both fictional and scientific, takes up an appreciable percentage of polity processing space. Mere written scientific dissertations and fictions amount to trillions of words. Quite a furore, really, considering the physical evidence for their existence would not fill even the smallest room in the British Museum. From Quince Guide, compiled by humans. Out of necessity, Mr. Crane wore a protective suit. The blasts of searing gas from the many volcanic vents, as well as the spills of glowing magma across the hellish landscape, were bad enough, and would eventually have melted his brass outer covering, despite its inlaid Escon grid. But there was also the acidic atmosphere that might have etched away that covering first. Skellor also wore a suit, but one he had extruded from inside himself. As the two of them trudged towards the wedge-shaped survey ship perched on the glowing ridge ahead, Skellor wondered if he was foolishly wasting time with this side jaunt, and if that sense of aesthetic correctness might prove his downfall. Skellor knew that though he possessed huge abilities to interact with and alter his environment, this was simply like possessing hands and eyes, for being able to use them did not necessarily mean you knew precisely how they operated. And though he could acquire information, knowledge, skills, he did not possess enough of them to take overt actions while ensuring sufficient personal safety. Some proof of this was how Cormac's simple ruse had lured him to Elysium, to within range of the sun mirrors. Then Skellor's lack of knowledge and his subsequent actions, which he equated to those of an impulsive adolescent, had nearly been fatal to him. Admittedly, it would have been difficult for him to know about Cormac's previous dealings with Drayden, the erstwhile ruler of Elysium, but thus putting himself within range of weapons capable of obliterating him had been stupid. He remembered, almost with a wince, the pain he had suffered while his Jane substructure in the Occam razor burned. Someone would pay for that. Drawing closer to the ship, Skellor saw two people clad in reflective hot suits heading down towards the Plain of Ash. It amused him that there were four people here searching for Jane artifacts. They would be very surprised and very chagrined when living Jane technology found them. Skellor pondered that irony. Though that was not his purpose here, he needed information about what he carried inside him. The Jane technology that was mutating in a way somehow hidden from him. And that information was not something he could acquire from the polity. However, one brief exchange between Cormac and Dragon, absorbed as part of his memory from recordings inside the Occam razor, had told him where to obtain such information. Dragon knew about Jane technology, and somewhere, probably on the perimeter of human space, two dragon spheres still lurked. But how to find them? As he and Crane began to climb the slope, Skellor reviewed what he thus far knew about Dragon. The creature, in its initial form of four conjoined spheres, had been a probe, a data gatherer sent by the Makers, a race of energy-based life forms located out in one of the Magellanic clouds. But it malfunctioned and started interacting with humanity, setting itself up as some sort of demigod on the planet Astacolora. Upon delivering some obscure judgment, it had then apparently destroyed itself. But as far as Skellor could work out, it had actually separated itself into four entities to surround and attack the Maker ship sent to retrieve or destroy it. The drastic events at Samarkand had then proceeded from there. One sphere destroyed by Cormac in the process. Events at Masada had since accounted for another sphere. From both faragos, Skellor could see that these entities liked to meddle in human affairs. Dragon now even had its own corporation operating in the polity, and its own networks of humans coming under its control via the DracoCorp biotech orgs. How these networks connected back to their controlling dragon spheres was the only firm lead he had. And with this small piece of business out of the way would be the one for him to pursue. But now it was time to look inside the survey vessel. There was no special code to operate the outside door, just a simple inset handle, easy to operate for someone in a hot suit. Skellor had already observed the carrier shell in orbit above, and with an earlier probe he had discovered that neither the shell nor this survey vessel it had transported here were run by AI. Therefore, such a simple door mechanism confirmed for him that both shell and vessel were old and privately owned. He pulled the handle up, and as the door swung open, he waved Crane ahead of him. The golem almost had to crouch to fit himself inside the airlock. Skellor followed, pushing up close to Crane and pulling the outer door closed. In a minute, the lock had filled with cooled air, and the safeties preventing him opening the inner door cut out. Crane was the first to duck inside. "What have you forgotten now?" asked someone from further inside the ship. Crane stood with his head bowed so as not to bang it against the ceiling. Skellor looked around. Here was the initial decontamination and rough cleaning area, and there were no artifacts in the isolation tank. But then, this four-man research team had not been here very long. Skellor had followed them out only a day after their departure. This team, he had learnt, consisted of three humans and one golem. A woman, easily identifiable as not being the golem, ducked through into the cabin and froze.
"Who the fuck are you?" she managed.
"Have you found anything yet?"
"Fuck off!"
"Unforgivable rudeness," said Skellor,
placing his hand against the control panel for the airlock. From the Jane substructure inside him, he sent filaments, searching, connecting, and overriding the safety system. He pointed to the open airlock.
"Mr. Crane, put her in there."
The woman had time only to let out a yelp and duck back a little way before Crane's hand closed on her shoulder. She struggled and began screaming, and just then one of the men ducked through from the other direction, holding level a small gas system pulse gun.
"Tell that thing to put her down," he demanded.
Skellor just turned and walked towards the man. Three shots slammed into his chest, opening smoking holes and flinging pieces of his Jane carapace across the deck. Reaching the man, he slapped the weapon away, grabbed him by the jacket, and almost negligently tossed him towards Crane, who caught hold of him in his other big hand.
"Well, our friend must be one of the other two, so let's go back outside," said Skellor.
The woman carried on, screaming and fighting. The man tried reasoning, but he too soon started to scream once the outer lock was open. Skellor was surprised at the tenacity with which a person could hang on to life. Even with smoke pouring from their clothing, their skin melting and slewing away, and contrails of flame whipping up and about their bodies, the two still tried to fight their way past Crane and back into the ship, which was filling with the same searing, acidic air anyway.
"Hey-ho," said Skellor, as the two finally died, and the heat began to blacken and contort them into ebony fetuses. "Let's go find the others."
Retroact 6. "Mission objective achieved is all I'm getting," said Angelina, her fingers pressed against the bean-shaped org behind her right ear.
"What about visual? Oral?"
John Stanton asked. "Nothing." Angelina shook her head. "It won't tell me anything more. It's almost as if it's shut down." "We know where it will be anyway, so no problem there." Now turning to face Semper and Stanton, she said, "I'll want you first to check that Starlek and that idiot Falco are both dead." And with that, she waved the two men ahead of her. Stanton closed his mouth on any further comments and tried to restrain his cynicism about this whole little outing. He drew his heavy pulse gun from its insulated holster in his hot suit. From his belt, he detached a small adhesive mine and held it in his left hand. He was just as unenamored with the idea of using a subverted golem as were many others in the Pelters organization. Facing forwards, he and Semper now advanced. Starlek had built his house on the equatorial belt of Huma, so it necessarily possessed a ceramic shell and thick, heavily insulated walls. At present, that insulation only served the purpose of maintaining a comfortable internal temperature against the constant 50 degrees outside, since the resinous incendiary briar that constituted most of the surrounding jungle had yet to achieve ripeness. In the distance, Stanton noted a column of smoke from where one patch of briar had reached that point in its growth where the sparks from its exploding seed pods ignited it. It was early, though. Later in the season, this entire continent would become an inferno, the briars burning down to provide plenteous ash in which the seeds could lie ready to germinate in the ensuing sooty rainstorms. Semper studied the door's palm lock, then let out a bark of laughter. He took a crowbar from his belt, jammed it under the lock, and levered the plate and attached console from the wall.
"Is that a good idea?" Stanton asked.
"It's a dummy," Semper explained. "Understandable, really. He has to be able to get in and out, wearing a hot suit, so he can't use something that operates by his palm print and DNA coding. Merely a simple input code."
Taking a small console from his belt, he unwound two optic cables, terminating in interface clamps, which he now closed on two optic cables trailing from the back of the lock and into the wall. Then he simply waited, while the device he still held did the job of safe breaker for him. The seals on the circular door eventually woomphed, and it hinged outwards to reveal an airlock and an inner door. Semper stared inside for a long moment before turning to Stanton.
"Now this I don't like," he said.
He stooped and picked up one of the many pieces of briar charcoal that were scattered on the ground, then tossed it into the lock. The thing that immediately dropped from the ceiling onto the charcoal was a wolf spider half a metre long. Only it was a spider with metal bracings and hydraulic pistons augmenting its legs, and a more complicated arrangement of gleaming motors augmenting its obsidian fangs.
"Jesus!" Semper bellowed.
Stanton's pulse gun sputtered white light, hitting the creature midair as it leapt out at them. It slammed back against the jam, hit the ground, and, smoking, made to leap again at Semper. Angelina drew her own weapon and fired, complementing the shot Stanton was again putting into the creature. Twice more it leapt, and their shots slammed it back. It only gave up when its organic body was reduced to a charcoal remnant inside its cyber-bracing skeleton.
"Okay, Semper. The door," ordered Angelina.
Stanton kept his weapon pointed at the cyborg spider as it slowly curled up its legs like a fist. Semper took rather longer over the true palm lock operating the second door. But soon they were stepping into the brightness of Stalek's home.
"Stanton, find his house system and neutralize it," Angelina instructed, herself making no move to go further into this strange home.
The big man moved on, rounding furniture seemingly fashioned from the carapaces of huge crustaceans, while keeping an eye on the large plants contained in pots scattered throughout the room. Plants whose beautifully coloured giant daffodil heads turned to track his progress. Reaching the further wall, he studied something set into it that looked more like a work of weird art than any technology, then stepped back, raising his weapon, and blasted it, his shots punching molten holes through the gleaming metalwork and oddly shaped touch panels and screens. The bright lights flickered briefly as they dropped from the control of a house AI to some backup safety system. Turning, Stanton fired twice at a plant, lowering its lime-green and purple-striped head towards him, severing its stalk. As the head dropped to the ground, it protruded a red tongue coated with small metal hooks.
"About as safe as we're gonna get," he observed.
Angelina pointed to a wooden door to Stanton's right. "We go there, up to the attic. That's where Stalek did his work."
She followed, giving the plants a wide berth, but staying well back so he and Semper would encounter first anything nasty, Stanton noted, as he operated the simple latch and opened the door.
The stairs winding up into the attic were lit by biolights, yet another sign of Starlek's attraction towards exotic technologies. Stanton eyed the spidery creatures with their glowing sugar bag bodies, then glanced back at Angelina.
"Why the hit on him?" he asked abruptly. "Seems to me he was providing you with some useful toys."
"Not really your concern," Angelina replied, "but he was becoming increasingly unstable, and some of his work was of questionable quality."
"So you have this lunatic subvert a Golem 25 android for you?"
"Just get up the stairs, mercenary," Angelina spat. Stanton nodded to himself and began to climb, thinking how Angelina and her brother Arion were not the best people to make judgments on the stability of others. However, Stanton was not about to push his luck too far. The money of these terrorist rich kids was still good. From the topmost landing, four wooden doors led off into different rooms, but Angelina, coming up closer behind Semper and Stanton, pointed to the one directly ahead. The rest also contained various workshops, but he uses that one for any final assembly. Adhesive mines still to hand, Stanton nodded to Semper, who shoved open the door in front of him. Stanton stepped into the room and then slid to one side, crouching down, pulse gun aimed, an adhesive mine held palm outwards in readiness. Semper did the same, moving to the other side of the door. Stanton noted that the man was just as trusting as himself. As well as brandishing a pulse gun, he held a small EM grenade. No action. Stanton slowly stood upright and surveyed the room. Starlek's and Falco's bodies were not visible, but Stanton tracked the trails of blood over to the clean viro booth and guessed where they might be.
"Find the fucking control module," said Angelina, obviously shaken by what she was seeing.
Stanton left Semper to go over to where wrecked computers and other equipment had been stacked in a corner of the room. Himself, he did not intend to turn his back on the room's other occupant. The golem had pulled a chair up in front of a table. It wore a long coat and a wide-brimmed hat. Before it on the table, several objects were laid out as if it was involved in some intricate game of chess with an unseen opponent. Those objects consisted of various tools and pieces of hardware, a small rubber dog, and two other gruesome